It was a warm spring night when a fist knocked at the door so hard that the hinges bent. A man opened it and peered out into the street. There was mist coming off the river, and it was a cloudy night. He might as well have tried to see through white velvet. But he thought afterwards that there had been shapes out there, just beyond the light spilling out into the road. A lot of shapes, watching him carefully. He thought maybe there had been very faint points of light. There was no mistaking the shape right in front of him, though. It was big and dark red, and looked like a child's clay model of a man. Its eyes were two embers. Well, what do you want at this time of night? The golem handed him a slate, on which was written, "We hear you want a golem." Of course, golems couldn't speak, could they? Ha. Want, yes. Afford, no. I've been asking set around, but it's wicked the prices you're going for these days. The golem rubbed the words off the slate and wrote, "To you, $100. You're for sale?" No. The golem lurched aside. Another one stepped into the light. It was also a golem. The man could see that. But it wasn't like the usual lumpen clay things that you occasionally saw. This one gleamed with a newly polished statue, perfect down to the detailing of the clothes. It reminded him of one of the old pictures of the city's kings, all haughty stance and imperious haircut. In fact, it even had a small coronet molded onto its head. $100, the man said suspiciously. What's wrong with it? Who's selling it? Nothing is wrong. Perfect in all detail. $90. Sounds like someone wants to get rid of it in a hurry. Golem must work. Golem must have a master. Yeah, right. But you hear stories. Going mad and making too many things and that. Not mad. $80. It looks new, said the man, tapping the gleaming chest. But no one's making golems anymore. That's what's keeping the price up beyond the purse of the small business. He stopped. Is someone making them again? $80. I heard the priests banned making them years ago. A man could get in a lot of trouble. $70. Who's doing it? $60. Is he selling them to Albertson? Or Spadger and Williams? It's hard enough competing as it is, and they've got the money to invest in new plant. $50. The man walked around the golem. A man can't sit by and watch his company collapse under him because of unfair price cutting. I mean to say, $40. Religion is all very well. But what do prophets know about profits, eh? He looked up at the sharpened, shapeless golem in the shadows. Was that $30 I just saw you write? Yes. I've always liked dealing wholesale. Wait one moment. He went back inside and returned with a handful of coins. Will you be selling any to the mother bastards? No. Good. Tell your boss it's a pleasure to do business with him. Get along inside, Sonny Jim. The white golem walked into the factory. The man, glancing from side to side, trotted in after it and shut the door. Deeper shadows moved in the dark. There was a faint hissing. Then rocking slightly, the big, heavy shapes moved away. Shortly afterwards, and around the corner, a beggar holding out a helpful hand for alms was amazed to find himself suddenly richer by a whole $30. The disc world turned against the glittering backdrop of space, spinning very gently on the backs of the four giant elephants that perched on the shell of a great Atuan, the star turtle. Continents drifted slowly past, topped by weather systems that themselves turned gently against the flow, like waltzers spinning counter to the whirl of the dance. A billion tons of geography rolled slowly through the sky. People looked down on stuff like geography and meteorology. And not only because they're standing on one and being soaked by the other. They don't look quite like real science. But geography is only physics slowed down and with a few trees stuck on it. And meteorology is full of excitingly fashionable chaos and complexity. And summer isn't a time, it's a place as well. Summer is a moving creature that likes to go south for the winter. Even on the Discworld, with its tiny orbiting sun tilting over the churning world, the seasons moved. And Ankh-Morpork, greatest of its cities, spring was nudged aside by summer, and summer was prodded in the back by autumn. Geographically speaking, there was not a lot of difference within the city itself. Although in later spring, the scum on the river was often a nice emerald green. The mist of spring became the fog of autumn, which mixed with fumes and smoke from the magical quarter and the workshops of the alchemists until it seemed to have a thick, choking life of its own. And time moved on. Autumn fog pressed itself against the midnight window panes. Blood ran in a trickle across the pages of a rare volume of religious essays, which had been torn in half. There had been no need for that, thought Father Tubalcheck. A further thought suggested that there had been no need to hit him either. But Father Tubalcheck had never been very concerned about that sort of thing. People healed, books didn't. He reached out shakily and tried to gather up the papers, but slumped back again. The room was spinning. The door swung open. Heavy footsteps creaked across the floor. One footstep, at least, and one dragging noise. Step, drag, step, drag. Father Dubalchuk tried to focus. "You?" he croaked. "Nod. Pick up the books." The old priest watched as the books were retrieved and piled carefully with fingers not well suited to the task. The newcomer took a quill pen from the debris, carefully wrote something on a scrap of paper, then rolled it up and placed it delicately between Father Tubalcheck's lips. The dying priest tried to smile. "We don't work like that," he mumbled, the little cylinder wobbling like a last cigarette. "We make our own." The kneeling figure watched him for a while, and then, taking great care, leaned forward slowly and closed his eyes. Commander Sir Samuel Vimes, Ankh-Morpork City Guard, frowned at himself in the mirror and began to shave. The razor was a sword of freedom. Shaving was an act of rebellion. These days, someone ran his bath. Every day. You wouldn't think the human skin could stand it. And someone laid out his clothes. Such clothes. And someone cooked his meals. What meals? He was putting on weight. He knew. And someone even polished his boots. And such boots. No cardboard-soled wrecks, but big, well-fitting boots of genuine shiny leather. There was someone to do nearly everything for him, but there were some things a man ought to do for himself, and one of them was shaving. He knew that Lady Sybil mildly disapproved. Her father had never shaved himself in his life. He had a man for it. Vimes had protested that he'd spent too many years trudging the nighttime streets to be happy about anyone else wielding a blade anywhere near his neck. But the real reason, the unspoken reason, was that he hated the very idea of the world being divided into the shaved and the shavers. Or those who wore the shiny boots and those who cleaned the mud off them. Every time he saw Wilkins the butler fold his Vimes's clothes, he suppressed a terrible urge to kick the butler's shiny backside as an affront to the dignity of man. The razor moved calmly over the stubble of the night. Last night, there had been some official dinner. He couldn't recall now what it had been for. He seemed to spend his whole life at the things. Arch giggling women, and brain young men who'd been at the back of the line when the chins were handed out. And as usual, he'd come back through the fog-bound city in a filthy temper with himself. He'd noticed a light under the kitchen door and heard conversation and laughter, and had gone in. Wilkins was there with the old man who stoked the boiler, and the head gardener, and the boy who cleaned the spoons and lit the fires. They were playing cards. There were bottles of beer on the table. He pulled up a chair and cracked a few jokes and asked to be dealt in. They'd been welcoming, in a way. But as the game progressed, Vimes had been aware of the universe crystallizing around him. It was like becoming a cogwheel in a glass clock. There was no laughter. They'd called him sir and kept clearing their throats. Everything was very careful. Finally, he'd mumbled an excuse and stumbled out. Halfway along the passage, he thought he'd heard a comment followed by, well, maybe it was only a chuckle, but it might have been a snigger. The razor carefully circumnavigated the nose. Ha! A couple of years ago, a man like Wilkins would have allowed him into the kitchen only on sufferance, and would have made him take his boots off. So that's your life now, Commander Sir Samuel Vimes. A jumped-up copper to the knobs, and a knob to the rest, eh? He frowned at the reflection in the mirror. He'd started out in the gutter, true enough, and now he was on 3 meat meals a day, good boots, a warm bed at night, and, come to that, a wife, too. Good old Sybil, although she did tend to talk about curtains these days. But Sergeant Cullen had said this happened to wives and was a biological thing and perfectly normal. He'd actually been rather attached to his old cheap boots. He could read the streets in them. The soles were so thin. It had got so that he could tell where he was on a pitch-dark night just by the feel of the cobbles. Not well. There was something mildly strange about Sam Fime's shaving mirror. It was slightly convex, so that it reflected more of the room than a flat mirror would do. And it gave a very good view of the outbuildings and gardens beyond the window. Going thin on top. Definitely a receding scalp there. Less hair to comb, but, on the other hand, more face to wash. There was a flicker in the glass. He moved sideways and ducked. The mirror smashed. There was the sound of feet somewhere beyond the broken window, and then a crash and a scream. Vimes straightened up. He fished the largest piece of mirror out of the shaving bowl and propped it up on the black crossbow bolt that had buried itself in the wall. He finished shaving. Then he rang the bell for the butler. Wilkins materialized. Sir? Vimes rinsed the razor. Get the boy to nip along to the glazier, will you? The butler's eyes flickered to the window and then to the shattered mirror. Yes, sir. And the bill to go to the Assassin's Guild again, sir? With my compliments. And while he's out, he's to call in at the shop in 5 7 yard and get me another shaving mirror. The dwarf there knows the kind I like. Yes, sir. And I shall fetch a dustpan and brush directly, sir. Shall I inform her ladyship of this eventuality, sir? No, she always says it's my fault for encouraging them. Very good, sir, said Wilkins. He dematerialized. Sam Vines dried himself off and went downstairs to the morning room, where he opened the cabinet and took out the new crossbow Sybil had given to him as a wedding present. Sam Vines was used to the old guard crossbows, which had a nasty habit of firing backwards in a tight corner. But this was burly and strong in the arm, made to measure chop, with the oiled walnut stock. There was none finer, it was said. Then he selected a thin cigar and strolled out into the garden. There was a commotion coming from the Dragon House. Vimes entered and shut the door behind him. He rested the crossbow against the door. The yammering and squeaking increased. Little gouts of flame puffed above the thick walls of the hatching pens. Vimes leaned over the nearest one. He picked up a newly hatched dragonet and tickled it under the chin. As it flamed excitedly, he lit his cigar and savored the smoke. He blew a smoke ring to the figure hanging from the ceiling. "Good morning," he said. The figure twisted frantically. By an amazing piece of muscle control, it had managed to catch a foot around a beam as it fell, but it couldn't quite pull itself up. Dropping was not to be thought of. A dozen baby dragons were underneath it, jumping up and down excitedly and flaming. "Good morning," said the hanging figure. "Turned out nice again," said Fimes, picking up a bucket of coal. "Although the fog will be back later, I expect." He took a small nugget of coal and tossed it to the dragons. They squabbled for it. Vimes gripped another lump. The young dragon that had caught the coal already had a distinctly longer and hotter flame. "I suppose," said the young man, "that I could not prevail upon you to let me down." Another dragon caught some thrown coal and belched a fireball. The young man swam desperately to avoid it. "Guess," said Vimes. "I suspect on reflection that it was foolish of me to choose the roof," said the assassin. "Probably," said Vimes. He'd spent several hours a few weeks ago sawing through joists and carefully balancing the roof tiles. "I should have dropped off the wall and used the shrubbery, possibly," said Vimes. "He'd set a bear trap in the shrubbery." He took some more coal. "I suppose you wouldn't tell me who hired you?" "I'm afraid not, sir. You know the rules." Vimes nodded gravely. "We had Lady Salachi's son up before the patrician last week," said Vimes. "Now there's a lad who needs to learn that no doesn't mean yes, please." "Could be, sir. And then there was that business with Lord Rust's boy." "You can't shoot servants for putting your shoes the wrong way around, you know. It's too messy. He'll have to learn right from left, like the rest of us." "And right from wrong, too." "I hear what you say, sir." "We seem to have reached an impasse," said Vimes. "It seems so, sir." Vimes aimed a lump at a small bronze and green dragon, which caught it expertly. The heat was getting intense. "What I don't understand," he said, "is why you fellows mainly try it here or at the office. I mean, I walk around a lot, don't I? You could shoot me down in the street, couldn't you?" "What, like some common murderer, sir?" Vimes nodded. It was black and twisted, but the Assassin's Guild had honor of a sort. How much was I worth?" 20,000, sir." "It should be higher," said Vimes. "I agree. If the assassin got back to the guild, it would be," Vimes thought. "Assassins value their own lives quite highly." "Let me see now," said Vimes, examining the end of his cigar. "Guild takes 50%. That leaves $10,000. The assassin seemed to consider this, and then reached up to his belt and tossed a bag rather clumsily toward Vimes, who caught it. Vimes picked up his crossbow. "It seems to me," he said, "that if a man were to be let go, he might well make it to the door with no more than superficial burns, if he were fast. How fast are you?" There was no answer. "Of course, he'd have to be desperate," said Vimes, wedging the crossbow on the feed table and taking a piece of cord out of his pocket. He lashed the cord to a nail and fastened the other end of the to the crossbow string. Then, standing carefully to one side, he eased the trigger. The string moved slightly. The assassin, watching him upside down, seemed to have stopped breathing. Vimes puffed at his cigar until the end was an inferno. Then he took it out of his mouth and leaned it against the restraining cord so that it would have just a fraction of an inch to burn before the string began to smolder. "I'll leave the door unlocked," he said. "I've never been an unreasonable man. I shall watch your career with interest." He tossed the rest of the coals to the dragons and stepped outside. It looked like being another eventful day in Ankh-Morpork Park, and it had only just begun. As Vimes reached the house, he heard a whoosh, a click, and the sound of someone running very fast towards the ornamental lake. He smiled. Willikins was waiting with his coat.
Remember you have an appointment with his lordship at 11, Sir Samuel. Yes, yes, said Vimes. And you are to go and see the heralds at 10. Her ladyship was very explicit, sir. Her exact words were, tell him he's not to try to wriggle out of it again, sir. Oh, very well. And her ladyship said, please try not to upset anyone. Tell her I'll try. And your sedan chair is outside, sir. Vimes sighed. Thank you. There's a man in the ornamental lake. Fish him out and give him a cup of tea, will you? Promising lad, I thought. Certainly, sir. The chair. Oh, yes, the chair. It had been a wedding present from the patrician. Lord Ventnor knew that Vimes loved walking the streets of the city. And so it was very typical of the man that he presented him with something that did not allow him to do so. It was waiting outside. The two bearers straightened up expectantly. Sir Samuel Vimes, commander of the city watch, rebelled again. Perhaps he did have to use the damn thing, but he looked at the front man and motioned with a thumb to the chair's door. Get in, he commanded. But, sir, it's a nice morning, said Vimes, taking off his coat again. I'll drive myself. Dearest Mum and Dad, Captain Kerr of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch was on his day off. He had a routine. First, he had a breakfast in some handy cafe. Then he wrote his letter home. Letters home always gave him some trouble. Letters from his parents were always interesting, but being full of mining statistics and exciting news about new shafts and promising seams. All he had to write about were murders and such things as that. He chewed the end of his pencil for a moment. Well, it has been an interesting week again, he wrote. I am running around like a fly with a blue bottom, and no mistake. We are opening another watch house at Chitling Street, which is handy for the shades. So now we have no less than 4, including Dolly Sisters and Long Wall, and I am the only captain, so I am around at all hours. Personally, I sometimes miss the camaraderie of the old days, when it was just me and Nobby and Sergeant Colin. But this is the century of the fruit bat. Sergeant Colin is going to retire at the end of the month. He says Mrs. Colin wants him to buy a farm. He says he is looking forward to the peace of the country and being close to nature. I'm sure you would wish him well. My friend Nobby is still Nobby, only more than he was. Karen absentmindedly took a half-eaten mutton chop from his breakfast plate and held it out below the table. There was an unk. Anyway, back to the job. Also, I am sure I have told you about the Cable Street particulars, although they are still based in Pseudopolis Yard. People do not like it when watchmen do not wear uniforms, but Commander Vimes says criminals don't wear uniforms either, so be damned to the lot of them. Carrot paused. It said a lot about Captain Carrot that even after almost 2 years in Ankh-Morpork, he was still uneasy about damned. Commander Vimes says you have to have secret policemen because there are secret crimes. Carrot paused again. He loved his uniform. He didn't have any other clothes. The idea of watchmen in disguise was unthinkable. It was like those pirates who sailed under false colors. It was like spies. However, he went on dutifully, and Commander Vimes knows what he is talking about, I am sure. He says it's not like old-fashioned police work, which was catching the poor devils too stupid to run away. Anyhow, it all means a lot more work and new faces in the watch. While he waited for a new sentence to form, Carrot took a sausage from his plate and lowered it. There was another unk, The waiter bustled up. Another helping Mr. Carrot? On the house. Every restaurant and eatery in Ankh-Morpork offered free food to Carrot, and the certain and happy knowledge that he would always insist on paying. No, indeed, that was very good. Here we are. 20 pence and keep the change. How's your young lady? Haven't seen her today. Angua? Oh, she's around and about. You know, I shall definitely tell her you asked after her, though. The dwarf nodded happily and bustled off. Carrot wrote another few dutiful lines and then said very softly, "Is that horse and cart still outside Ironcrust's bakery?" There was a whine from the under the table. "Really, that's odd. All the deliveries were over hours ago, and the flour and grit don't usually arrive until the afternoon. Driver still sitting there?" Something barked quietly. "And that looks quite a good horse for a delivery cart. And, you know, normally you'd expect the driver to put a nose back on, and it's the last Thursday in the month, which is payday at Ironcrust's." Carrot laid down his pencil and waved a hand politely to catch the waiter's eye. "Cup of acorn coffee, Mr. Cumlet. To take away?
In the Dwarf Bread Museum in Whirligig Alley, Mr. Hopkinson, the curator, was somewhat excited. Apart from other considerations, he'd just been murdered, but at the moment he was choosing to consider this as an annoying background detail. He'd been beaten to death with a loaf of bread. This is unlikely even in the worst of human bakeries, but dwarf bread has amazing properties as a weapon of offense. Dwarfs regard baking as part of the act of warfare. When they make rock cakes, no simile is intended. "Look at this dent here," said Hopkinson. "It's quite ruined the crust."
And your skull, too," said Death.
"Oh, yes," said Hopkinson, in the voice of one who regards skulls as 10 a penny, but is well aware of the rarity value of a good bread exhibit. "But what was wrong with a simple kosh? Or even a hammer? I could have provided one if asked." Death, who was by nature an obsessive personality himself, realized that he was in the presence of a master. The late Mr. Hopkinson had a squeaky voice and wore his spectacles on a length of black tape. His ghosts now wore their spiritual counterpart, and these were always the sign of a mind that polished the underside of furniture and stored paperclips by size. "It really is too bad," said Mr. Hopkinson, "and ungrateful, too. After the help I gave them with the oven, I really feel I shall have to complain." "Mr. Hopkinson, are you fully aware that you are dead?"
"Dead?" chilled the curator. "Oh, no, I can't possibly be dead. Not at the moment. It's simply not convenient. I haven't even catalogued the combat muffins." "Nevertheless..."
No, I'm sorry, but it just won't do. You will have to wait. I really cannot be bothered with that sort of nonsense." Death was nonplussed. Most people were, after the initial confusion, somewhat relieved when they died. A subconscious weight had been removed. The other cosmic shoe had dropped. The worst had happened, and they could metaphorically get on with their lives. Few people treated it as a simple annoyance that might go away if you complained enough. Mr. Hopkinson's hand went through a tabletop. "Oh. You see? This is most uncalled for. Couldn't you have arranged a less awkward time?" "Only by a consultation with your murderer. It all seems very badly organized. I wish to make a complaint. I pay my taxes, after all. I am Death, not taxes. I turn up only once." The shade of Mr. Hopkinson began to fade. "It's simply that I've always tried to plan ahead in a sensible way. I find that the best approach is to take life as it comes." "That seems very irresponsible. It's always worked for me." The sedan chair came to a halt outside Pseudopolis Yard. Vimes left the runners to park it
and strode in, putting his coat back on. There had been a time, and it seemed like only yesterday, when the watch house had been almost empty. There'd be old Sergeant Cullen dozing in his chair, and Corporal Knobs is washing, drying in the front of the stove. And then suddenly it had all changed. Sergeant Cullen was waiting for him with a clipboard. "Got the reports from the other watch houses, sir," he said, trotting along beside Fimes. "Anything special?"
"Been a bit of an odd murder, sir."
Down in one of them old houses on Misbegot Bridge. Some old priest. Dunno much about it. The patrol just said it ought to be looked at." "Who found him?"
"Constable visit, sir."
"Oh, gods. Yes, sir. I'll try to get along there this morning." "Anything else?"
"Corporal Knobs is sick, sir."
"Oh, I know that. I mean off sick, sir."
"Not his granny's funeral this time?"
"No, sir."
How many's he had this year, by the way?"
7, sir." "Very odd family, the Knobses."
"Yes, sir."
"Fred, you don't have to keep calling me sir."
Got company, sir," said the sergeant, glancing meaningfully toward a bunch of a bench in the main office.
"Come for that alchemy job." A dwarf smiled nervously at Vimes.
"All right," said Vimes. I'll see him in my office." He reached into his coat and took out the assassin's money pouch.
"Put it in the widows and orphans fund, will you, Fred?"
"Right. Oh, well done, sir. Any more windfalls like this, and we'll soon be able to afford some more widows."
Sergeant Cullen went back to his desk, surreptitiously opened his drawer, and pulled out the book he was reading. It was called Animal Husbandry. He'd been a bit worried about the title. You heard stories about strange folk in the country, but it turned out to be nothing more than a book about how cattle and pigs and sheep should breed. Upstairs, Vimes pushed open his office door, carefully. The Assassin's Guild played to rules. You could say that about the bastards. It was terribly bad form to kill a bystander. Apart from anything else, you wouldn't get paid. So traps in his office were out of the question, because too many people were in and out of it every day. Even so, it paid to be careful. Vimes was good at making the kind of rich enemies who could afford to employ assassins. The assassins had to be lucky only once, but Vimes had to be lucky all the time. He slipped into the room and glanced out of the window. He liked to work with it open, even in cold weather. He liked to hear the sounds of the city, but anyone trying to climb up or down into it would run into everything in the way of loose tiles, shifting handholds, and treacherous drain pipes that Vimes ingeniously could contrive. And Vimes had installed spiked railings down below. They were nice and ornamental, but they were, above all, spiky. So far, Vimes was winning. There was a tentative knock at the door. It had issued from the knuckles of the dwarf applicant. Vimes ushered him into office,
shut the door,
and sat down at his desk. "So," he said, "you're an alchemist. Acid sand stains on your hands and no eyebrows.
"That's right, sir."
"Not usual to find a dwarf in that line of work. You people always seem to toil in your uncle's foundry or something. "You people," the dwarf noted. "Can't get the hang of metal," he said. "A dwarf who can't get the hang of metal? That must be unique. Pretty rare, sir. But I was quite good at alchemy."
"Guild member?"
"Not anymore, sir."
"Oh, how did you leave the guild?"
"Through the roof, sir. But I'm pretty certain I know what I did wrong." Vimes leaned back. "The alchemists are always blowing things up. I never heard of them getting sacked for it."
"That's because no one's ever blown up the guild council, sir."
"What, all of it?"
"Most of it, sir. All the easily detachable bits, at least."
Vimes found he was automatically opening the bottom drawer of his desk.
He pushed it shut again, and instead shuffled the papers in front of him. "What's your name, lad?" The dwarf swallowed. This was clearly the bit he'd been dreading. "Little Bottom, sir." Vimes didn't even look up. "Ah, yes, it says here. That means you're from the Uberwald mountain area, yes?" "Why, yes, sir," said Little Bottom, mildly surprised. Humans generally couldn't distinguish between dwarf clans. "Our constable Angua comes from there," said Vimes. "Now, it says here, your first name is... can't read Red's handwriting, or..." There was nothing for it. "Cheery, sir," said Cheery Little Bottom. "Cheery, eh? Good to see the old naming traditions kept up. Cheery Little Bottom, fine." Little Bottom watched carefully. Not the faintest glimmer of amusement had crossed Vimes' face. "Yes, sir, Cheery Little Bottom," he said. And there still wasn't as much as an extra wrinkle there. "My father was jolly. Jolly Little Bottom," he added, as one might prod at a bad tooth to see when the pain will come. "Really? And his father was Beaky Little Bottom." Not a trace, not a smidgen of a grin twitched anywhere. Vimes merely pushed the paper aside. "Well, we work for a living here, Little Bottom." "Yes, sir." "We don't blow things up, Little Bottom." "No, sir. I don't blow everything up, sir. Some just melts." Vimes drummed his fingers on the desk. "Know anything about dead bodies?" They were only mildly concussed, sir." Vimes sighed. "Listen, I know about how to be a copper. It's mainly walking and talking. But there's a lot of things I don't know. You find the scene of a crime, and there's some gray powder on the floor." "What is it?" "I don't know. But you fellows know how to mix things up in bowls and can find out. And maybe the dead person doesn't seem to have a mark on them. Were they poisoned? It seems we need someone who knows what color a liver is supposed to be. I want someone who can look at the ashtray and tell me what kind of cigars I smoke." "Pantweed Slim Panatellas," said Little Bottom automatically. "Good God, you've left the packet on the table, sir." Vimes looked down. "All right," he said. "So sometimes it's an easy answer, but sometimes it isn't. Sometimes we don't even know if it was the right question." He stood up. I can't say I like dwarfs much, Little Bottom, but I don't like trolls or humans either, so I suppose that's okay. Well, you're the only applicant. $30 a month, $5 living out allowance. I expect you to work to the job, not the clock. There's some mythical creature called overtime. Only no one's ever seen its footprints. If troll officers call you a grit sucker, they're out. And if you call them rocks, you're out. We're just one big family, and when you've been to a few domestic disputes, Little Bottom, I can assure you that you'll see the resemblance. We work as a team, and we're pretty much making it up as we go along. And half the time, we're not even certain what the law is. So it can get interesting. Technically, you'll rank as a corporal, only don't go giving orders to real policemen. You're on a month's trial. We'll give you some training just as soon as there's time. Now, find an iconograph and meet me on Miss Pagot Bridge, and damn, better make it an hour. I've got to see about this blasted coat of arms. Still, dead bodies seldom get deader. Sergeant Detritus? There was a series of creaks as something heavy moved along the corridor outside, and a troll opened the door. Yes, sir? This is Corporal Littlebottom, Corporal Cheery Littlebottom, whose father was Jolly Littlebottom. Give him his badge. Swear him in. Show him where everything is. Very good, Corporal. I shall try to be a credit to the uniform, sir, said Littlebottom. Good, said Vimes briskly. He looked to Detritus. Incidentally, Sergeant, I've got a report here that a troll in uniform nailed one of Chrysoprase's henchmen to a wall by his ears last night. Know anything about that? The troll wrinkled its enormous forehead. Does it say anything about him selling bags of slab to troll kids?
No, it says he was going to read spiritual literature to his dear old mother, said Vimes. Did Hardcore say he saw this troll's badge? No, but he says the troll threatened to ram it where the sun doesn't shine, said Vimes.
Detritus nodded gravely. That's a long way to go just to ruin a good batch, he said. By the way, said Vimes, that was a lucky guess of yours, guessing that it was Hardcore. It come to me in a flash, sir, said Detritus. What bastard who sells slab to kids deserves being nailed up by his ears, sir? And bingo, this idea just formed in my head. That's what I thought. Cheery little bottom looked from one impassive face to the other. The watchman's eyes never left each other's face, but the words seemed to come from a little distance, as though both of them were reading an invisible script. Then Detritus shook his head slowly. Must have been an imposter, sir. It's easy to get helmets like ours. None of my trolls did do anything like that. That would be police brutality, sir. Glad to hear it. Just for the look of the thing, though, I want you to check the trolls' lockers. The Silicone Anti-Defamation League are on to this one. Yes, sir. And if I find out it was one of my trolls, I will be down on that troll like a ton of rectangular building things, sir. Fine. Well, off you go, Little Bottom. Detritus, we'll look after you. Little Bottom hesitated. This was uncanny. The man hadn't mentioned axes or gold. He hadn't even said anything like, "You can make it big in the watch." Little Bottom felt really unbalanced. I did tell you my name, didn't I, sir? Yes, got it down here, said Vimes. Cheery Little Bottom, yes?
Yes, that's right. Well, thank you, sir.
Vimes listened to them go down the passage. Then he carefully shut the door and put his coat over his head so that no one would hear him laughing. Cheery Little Bottom. Cheery ran after the troll called Detritus. The watch house was beginning to fill up, and it was clear that the watch dealt with all sorts of things, and that many of them involved shouting. Two uniformed trolls were standing in front of Sergeant Colin's high desk, with a slightly smaller troll between them. This troll was wearing a downcast expression. It was also wearing a tutu and had a small pair of gauze wings glued to its back. Happen to know that trolls don't have any tradition of a tooth fairy, Colin was saying. Especially not one called, he looked down, Clinkerbell. So how about it we just call it breaking and entering without a thieves' guild license? It's racial prejudice not letting trolls have a tooth fairy, Clinkerbell muttered. One of the troll guards upended a sack on the desk. Various items of silverware cascaded over the paperwork. And this is what you found under their pillows, was it? Said Colin. Bless their little hearts, said Clinkerbell. At the next desk, a tired dwarf was arguing with a vampire. Look, he said. It's not murder. You're dead already, right? He stuck them right in me. Well, I've been down to interview the manager, and he said it was an accident. He said he's got nothing against vampires at all. He says he was merely carrying 3 boxes of HB eraser tips and tripped over the edge of your cloak. I don't see why I can't work where I like. Yes, but in a pencil factory? Detritus looked down at Little Bottom and grinned. Welcome to the to life in der big city, Little Bottom, he said. That's an interesting name. Is it? Most dwarfs have names like Rockheaver or Strong in the Arm, do they? Detritus was not one for the fine detail of relationships, but the edge in Little Bottom's voice got through to him. It's a good name, though, he said. What's slab? Said Cheery. It are chloric ammonium and radium mixed up. It give your head a tingle, but melts troll brains. Big problem in der mountains, and some buggers are making it here in der city, and we trying to find out how it get up there. Mr. Vimes is letting me run a detritus concentrated public awareness campaign telling people what happens to buggers who sell it to kids. He waved a hand at a large and rather crudely done poster on the wall. It said,
"Slab, just say, Arrgh!"
He pushed open a door.
"This is their old privy, what we don't use no more. You can use it for mixing up stuff. It's the only place we got now. You have to clean it up first, because it smells like a toilet in here." He opened another door. "And this der locker room," he said. You got your own peg in dat. And there's these panels for getting changed behind, because we know you dwarfs is modest. It a good life if you don't weaken. Mr. Vimes is okay, but he a bit weird about some stuff. He keeping on saying stuff like this city is a melting pot and all dirt scum floats to their top, and stuff like that. I'll give you your helmet and badge in a minute, but first," he opened a rather larger locker on the other side of the room, which had detritus painted on it. "I got to go and hide this hammer." Two figures hurried out of Iron Cross Dwarf Bakery to bread with the edge, threw themselves onto the cart, and shouted at the driver to leave urgently. He turned a pale face toward them and pointed to the road ahead. There was a wolf there. Not a usual kind of wolf. It had a blonde coat, which around its ears was almost long enough to be a mane. And wolves did not normally sit calmly on their haunches in the middle of a street. This one was growling. A long, low growl. It was the audible equivalent of a shortening fuse. The horse was transfixed, too frightened to stay where it was, but far too terrified to move. One of the men carefully reached for a crossbow. The growl rose slightly. He even more carefully took his hand away. The growl subsided again. "What is it?" "It's a wolf. In a city? What does it find to eat? Oh, why did you have to ask that?" "Good morning, gentlemen," said Carrot, as he stopped leaning against the wall. "Looks like the fog's rising again. Thieves Guild licenses, please." They turned. Carrot gave them a happy smile and nodded encouragingly. One of the men patted his coat in a theatrical display of absentmindedness. "Left the house in a bit of a hurry this morning. Must have forgotten. Section 2, Rule 1 of the Thieves Guild Charter says that members must carry their cards on all professional occasions," said Carrot. "He's not even drawn his sword," hissed the most stupid of the three strong gang. "He doesn't need to. He's got a loaded wolf."